You're listening to 89.5 KPOO San Francisco.
You asked me, Dad, can I play in the street? My big thought then was the shoes on your feet. Marched and sang as we took to the streets to protest war back in 1919. The oil and cars are our enemies, and the roads they build just get us in deep. But the truth shines sweet as we think for ourselves, as we wait for a chance to build heaven, not hell. Resistance.
To demonstrate our power,
Daughter Spring 17. I asked you, Spring, hey, how did it feel? Did the burning spray interfere with your breathing? Did it last way past that they gave you some water? Was it painful for just 1 or 2 hours?
Don't know what it like to be tortured, but you feel it now because I am your daughter. We locked down to stop the madness and slaughter, and don't back down or our struggle will falter.
Listening to 89.5 KPOO San Francisco. This is Reality Sandwich. I'm Martin Matthews. I'm a medical hypnotherapist and health for living advocate. And today on Reality Sandwich, where each week we serve up a palatable taste of the truth, which is a rare commodity out there in our world today, where we've got the major news networks creating news stories for us. This has been out in the news lately, where PR firms will go out and create the news and sell to NBC or CBS or whoever the heck else, and they play it for you. So our perspective on the world, global happenings, is getting further and further away from any realm of reality. I am here today with one of my co-hosts and noted oil industry expert, Jan Lundberg. Hi, Jan.
Hi, Martin. It's great to be here.
Thanks for being here today. We have a lot to accomplish today, so I'm going to just jump right in as I organize my notes. Today's topics, we're going to talk today about petroleum, about plastics, and about peace.
And you mentioned the first one, propaganda.
Yeah, propaganda as well. Well, first, as I organize my notes, Jan, I'd like you to tell our audience a little bit about your background and where you come from with respect to the oil industry and global sustainability issues, and your website, culturechange.org.
Certainly. It was in 1988 that I left serving the oil industry and government, and I founded the Fossil Fuels Policy Action Institute. And that went through a couple of major projects and name changes, such as the Alliance for a Paving Moratorium, and we published the Auto Free Times magazine, which got a new name a few years ago, Culture Change. And all this drew upon my oil industry experience, which started in 1972, and this was in time to start up the Lundberg Letter just before the Arab oil embargo. And after a few years, the Lundberg Letter became known as the Bible of the industry. And in 1979, we predicted the second oil shock by calculating how much gasoline was going to be absent from the market. So that was my background, looking at price and supply, and we broadened our work into other fuels and other sectors of the industry and utilities and assisting the EPA and Department of Energy as well.
So you would be considered today somebody who knows a bit about what's going on with respect to petroleum on the planet, how we use it, our global oil reserves, where we stand with respect to using oil, petroleum that is, for energy and everything else that we use it for on the planet. Is that fair to say?
Well,
I mean, you know what you're talking about.
If you say so, Martin.
I mean, yeah. I mean, I've been to your site. I've been reading a lot of the articles that are connected into your website. You have a lot of a tremendous number of resources there at culturechange.org for folks to learn about this. So I'm glad to have you with me today. Thanks for being here.
Well, it's a vital topic. People are using energy as if there's no tomorrow. And people aren't aware that it's more than just the gasoline they put in their car or the light that comes on when they flick a switch. It's very deep. It has to do with our food supply, all the things we use involving plastic, asphalt, the tires. So if we are running short of oil and the price is about to go up and up and up, how will this affect the way we live? And can we live in a world that is using energy so wastefully?
Well, let's first talk about that. Are we running out? I mean, this is a huge subject. The term being thrown around is peak oil, that according to noted, what is it, a geologist, Hubbert, created this curve.
Yes.
And the theory is that we are reaching the peak of our ability to extract oil from the earth, and that once we reach a point where we've pulled the most out of the earth, the most out of the ground, that we're heading down a slope on the other side, which may not necessarily be a gradual decline, as a standard bell curve would indicate, but could be a very sharp drop off, because getting the rest out could be very difficult to do, if possible at all, and very cost prohibitive. So there's been a lot of news about this, at least in the areas that I've been reading, real news, not CNN, not NBC, not CBS, not ABC, and a lot of information supported by a tremendous amount of scientific fact and corroborated by an analysis of looking at world events today that point to there's a lot of stuff going on with respect to, is there a lot of oil left on the planet? Yet others contend that in discussions I've had with folks recently that take a perspective of, oh, you know, there's a lot of alternatives. In the past, the world has run out of certain things, and we've always come up with something new. We've got wind. We've got solar. There are other gurus out there who've put forth theories that we're going to, you know, figure it out. We're going to slowly wean our way off of this. We're going to change our policy. We're going to change our ways. And I'm trying to get to the truth. What's really going on here in the world? Are we really dangerously and unbeknownst to most of us heading towards a potential cliff, an energy crisis on the planet? Or is it all going to be okay, in your opinion?
Well, why are we and Britain in Iraq? The country supposedly has the second largest oil reserves in the world. That area is very strategic, and there's a long history of involvement of imperial oil powers trying to get at that resource and corner the market and to continue to profit on it and grow demand up and up so that there would be maximum industrial development and profits to be made. There is an end to things. The earth is finite, and we may be looking at a gigantic economic bubble today based on all this petroleum activity. You mentioned some of the substitutes for petroleum and rosy scenarios for muddling through this or changing to other fuels. There really is nothing like petroleum for the energy content and the multitude of uses that we get from it. And I mentioned some of those before. So what we have now is a probable approximate peak in global oil extraction. The U.S. hit its peak over 30 years ago, and that was according to the Hubbert curve as well. So with petroleum being maxed out in demand possibly and production possibly, we may have quite an economic shock in store as soon as the market senses that there is a widening gap between supply and demand. Prices are going to go through the roof.
Let's talk about that for a second. In your recent article in Electric Vehicle Magazine, you mentioned in there that the world needs to produce another 2.7 million barrels per day by the end of this year, by the end of 2005, in order just to stand still. So where do you get that information, and what is that based upon?
Well, the OPEC countries and the oil industry and governments such as the U.S. and Britain put out these statistics. Another source is the International Energy Agency. And not all the figures agree, but pretty much it is agreed that there is not much more room for jacking up production of crude oil extraction or refining capacity. So things are really running on the edge. Things are very tight with the market. We had a record price level on oil futures last Thursday of $57.60 per barrel. And although that is considerably lower than what was happening in the 70s and early 80s, if you factor in inflation, nevertheless, the direction and the situation we find ourselves in with global trends is something that should make us ask, is this the final energy crisis? Are we going to see prices never come down but instead go up and up and up? So we don't know. And we should always ask ourselves, is this latest price record the point of no return?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot to look into around global events to gain a greater understanding of this. I mean, we're at a time where there's more military action going on in the world now than there has been in a long, long time. I know that on Michael Rupert's website, I follow his site quite a bit, fromthewilderness.com. He has an overlay map of the oil discoveries in the last couple of years, overlaid with U.S. military deployments across the globe. And you know, direct correlation seems that anywhere we find any new oil deposit, there seems to be suddenly a U.S. military presence there to ensure that the U.S. gets there to extract it, to drill, to research for it.
It's true, but it is a losing game. Basic trends cannot be turned around no matter how much military or diplomatic pressure may be applied.
A few more stats that I'm glancing at here are that well, here's something from the China news agency, that global demand may average 84 million barrels a day in 2005, while daily production in January was only 83.6 million. So we're already operating at a deficit.
it is turning out that way, and yet demand may be falling off because of the supply. However, there isn't a lot of wiggle room for the economy. The economy depends on growth. Stagnation and negative growth is anathema to the whole financial system. Now, people will get by fine consuming less, but the whole economy does depend on ever-expanding consumption. The number one factor in economic health is the consumer sector. So we have to do our part to consume less petroleum. Now, if this is bad for the global economy, so be it. And the other substitute forms of energy and fuels are not ready to be substituted. So it's time to talk about a new way of getting around, of growing our food, of using resources, and running our own lives and communities.
Let's address the naysayers for a moment. There's plenty of people listening right now who don't believe this. You know, it's not on the news. It's not in the mainstream. Nobody is warning them that we may be facing a major energy crisis on the planet. Nobody wants to talk about these things. I mean, even now, just hearing about it, it sounds, you know, semi-ludicrous to discuss because it's not anywhere in the realm of our memory from history talking about such a thing.
And the wheels are still rolling out in the street.
Yeah, the SUVs are still selling. Prices are going up. But hey, we're encouraged to consume more. We're making more things out of plastic. We're becoming more and more dependent every single day. So we are essentially driving towards a brick wall without even knowing it. But so often in those cases, nobody wants to be told that that's what's happening.
What they can do is find out for themselves. If they really want to be naysayers and point a finger at us and say we're doom and gloomers or that we're chicken littles, the sky is falling, it really is incumbent upon people to know what's going on. We need to think for ourselves and take action.
I spoke about this recently with a colleague of mine who does futures scenario planning and looking at global perspectives and such. And a couple of comments that came back that I think might be that I'm finding to be very consistent in the discussions that I've had. And in talking about this peak oil topic, he says back to me that the bottom line is that history has proven that when things get scarce, the price goes up, we find substitutes, innovate, we get creative, and we go on. Oil is no different from some of the other substances that society has gotten hooked on.
Well, let's look at history. When Western Europe decimated the forests, they had to go to coal. And a spin was put on this known as the Industrial Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
But wouldn't it be nicer if they had all those ancient forests there still intact? Well, going to coal had great costs. And true, there was innovation to get that coal out of the ground and transport it and use it in ways to keep trade growing and to accommodate population growth. But was it really a good thing? So we have to wonder, is progress good? And what is progress? What do we really need? And what has happened in history to put us in this untenable position of maximizing resources, resource use, with the ever-growing population?
Hmm. The other thing that most people say is that there's so many visible alternatives that we're working on. Solar, wind, batteries, natural gas, hydrogen, nuclear.
Geothermal.
Running my car on corn. All these other alternatives. I was pointed to a recent book, actually, by Amory Lovins called Winning the Oil Endgame, where he plots out a wonderful future scenario about how we can actually do this, how we can wean ourselves off of petroleum dependence. Within a few decades, he says, double the fuel efficiency of cars and trucks and airplanes, replace gasoline with alternative fuels. These are a few of the things that he mentions in his book. And it sounds wonderful to me. But then I read this and I go, oh, over the next few decades, and basically the net that I get from this perspective, whether it's from Mr. Lovins or others who articulate these things to me, is all we have to do to survive and deal with this is change. All we have to do is change our policies, change our way of being, change everything we put in place.
Well, they really don't say change the system. Now, a lot of these technological changes and management changes that they're advocating would have been very good and helpful maybe 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's too little and too late. And the scenario they're painting there really doesn't take into account the effect of peak oil. If peak oil is hitting now or about to hit, then the idea of a transition, keeping the industrial economy going and totally ignoring population size, which is dependent upon this nonstop growing amount of petroleum, well, then it starts to become very unrealistic. And we have to look at the reason that environmentalists such as Amory Lovins, Lester Brown, Jeremy Rifkin, and most of the funded environmental groups, how they can simply push the technological fix and not look at the reality of peak oil or overpopulation or the shortcomings of these other forms of energy that don't have the energy punch that petroleum offers.
Mm. You know, it sounds to me, I was thinking about this morning, that it sounds like the Earth is, in a way, an alcoholic with liver cancer. You know, we've been doing it for so long, and now that all these things are showing up, now we want to suddenly change something. Now we want to get out and stop, you know, being so dependent on something that's causing us so many problems.
However, we don't want to go on a fast.
However, we don't want to have to change.
Give me a form of booze that is less harmful and has unlimited supply. There's all these things out there, solar or wind. Well, we really should talk about these substitutes and how sick we are. And it really does come down to fundamental change of our economy, of how we relate to one another. Look at the average U.S. Settlement that is dependent on never-ending roads and cars and the electric grid. People are consuming things from very far away. The average piece of food travels 1,500 miles before mm-hmm. it is eaten in this country. And with this system in place that is very vulnerable to the termination of petroleum supply, people are able to be isolated consumers, so they're in their homes with their own little food supply. They've got their electric refrigerator, their computers, their dishwashing machine, their clothes washer and dryer, computer, their cars, no end of light switches, stereo equipment, and the list goes on. All these things require electricity, plastics, and the transport and packaging of all these so-called goods. And a lot of them are just coming from China. And how sustainable is that? So if we look at the average consumer in this country being so isolated and alienated, we have to wonder, can people get together and function anymore the way we did for the million so years of our evolution,
mm-hmm.
and even though civilization is relatively recent in our human experience, going back 10,000 years to the Middle East, a Western civilization, that is, this is something that leads us now to a form of non-cooperative and antisocial cultural values, where the idea is just to get more material things and to put up our little walls to keep consuming and call it success. And what if we don't have the energy to perpetuate this broken model, and we have to start sharing and we have to start doing things together in our neighborhoods? We're going to have to wonder, where's the food supply going to come from? And even if people started depaving their driveways and parking lots and mm-hmm. Tore up their lawns and started planting food, there's some lead time so that people can actually get some food production going. If people wait till the food is not coming in through the trucks to Safeway and Albertsons and Walmart, et cetera, then it's going to be very late. So that's why it's important to have these discussions and for people to look to alternative media instead of the corporate media, which is not telling the story, as you pointed out earlier.
I just don't get that people, and again, being very general, the planet is really understanding how dependent our life here is to energy, the ability to make food, to transport food, and how correlated population growth on the planet is with the discovery of oil and our ability to sustain ourselves and to grow our population and to essentially to feed ourselves. So every time this subject comes up, I sound and I feel so alarmist, and I feel like I'm conveying information that people don't want to know. And but I also feel that it is part of my purpose to speak of things that we wouldn't normally get otherwise, because, you know, if there was a tidal wave coming and you knew it, you really should yell. You really should say something. And I don't want to be alarmist on this show or in my personal interactions with people, but I do want to just bring things to people's awareness so that they can at least know something that they may not have known previously, and at least just check it out a little bit so that we're not walking around blindly trusting those that are telling us that the world will be just okay and you just keep on working as hard as you can, making less money and drinking your Starbucks and just doing your thing. So
that's what's happening. Those of us who can afford to survive in this brutal economy, the disadvantage you have and that we have in this movement is that we don't have a bead on where exactly that tidal wave is.
Mm-hmm.
And so because it isn't breaking right on top of our heads, people can afford to ignore it. They've got their heads in the sand.
But there is and there are things happening around the world that do would indicate that, you know, maybe this is happening sooner rather than later. Activity with China, China's consumption going up, world oil production not increasing. None of the major oil companies are investing in further infrastructure or building new oil tankers, right? So they seem to know something is up. What was it recently? Pemex, or, you know, they vetoed on this notion of drilling because it was going to be too costly to drill in the Gulf to extract the oil that they knew that was there. So things are happening that point in this direction. And if folks are listening, what do you recommend to them to at least just learn more? I don't want to give everybody necessarily a kit. Here's what you should do to go out and change your life and your world tomorrow. But where can they learn a little bit more about this subject and if, in fact, there is an energy crisis coming?
Well, we've given them an idea of what people need to know to understand the real trends going on. You've mentioned our website, culturechange.org. There are a number of oil-related sites. There are some publications out there. If one is really interested in energy issues and the effect that our consumption has on the planet, such as climate change, it really stands to reason that people don't need more information. They need to be wiser and act with some common sense. Let's take the automobile, for example. The car is a devastating factor on our health, on the environment, on the climate, and never-ending production of these machines is something that contributes to the continued impoverishment of the world from a resource standpoint, but also in this country alone kills about 100,000 people every year between the crashes mm-hmm. and the death from disease caused by the fumes. So when we look at terrorism, it turns out it's very, very low on the list as to actually being one of the causes of death in this country or anywhere in the world. But the fear factor is being employed so that people can take power, stay in power, and I think we can attribute the tendency of the current Republican administration in Washington, D.C. to this. But in looking at the car, it is packaged as something sexy, necessary, that we have to associate with success. But really, it's time to question the dependence on the car for daily use, certainly. And there are alternatives. I took BART from the East Bay and my bicycle from BART over to this station here. And there are other major decisions people need to make as to where they live, how they live. If a job is far away and driving is necessary, maybe we need to get another job closer to home. Or maybe we can live closer to the job. That is a very basic thing that we're going to all have to deal with eventually. As to things people can do, just the daily amount of energy we use, it isn't just in that flick of the light switch I mentioned. We have to look at our food sources. If you see some fruit from Argentina or Chile and you're in this country and it's out of season, maybe we should buy the local fruit as best we can.
Right. Well, thank you for expanding our awareness on this peak oil subject. And on a related subject now, we're going to move on to another topic. I wanted to talk about three things today: petroleum, plastics, which is related to petroleum, of course, and then a little bit later we'll speak about the peace movement and where we are. But let's shift to plastics for a moment. I was with you last night in Oakland at the Lake Merritt Community Center, right? Grand Lake Community Center. And we watched a documentary on plastics. And this is a subject we spoke briefly before on Reality Sandwich. And it's something that I never knew about until I met you and Paul, that the toxicity of plastics and how pervasive they are in our world, that everything that's ever been made of plastic in the history of the Earth still exists. Somewhere.
Well, it may have been ground down to smaller particles, but yes, you're right.
But it's not biodegrading. It's not going away. It's still here somewhere. We use it. We throw it away without even thinking about it. And it's piling up in our oceans, and our fish are eating it, and the birds are dying from it, and it's really upsetting. I had no idea this was happening.
Yes. Well, thanks to the work of the Algalita Marine Research Foundation, which put together that film we saw last night, Our Synthetic Sea, there is finally a movement starting to deal with this plastic trash problem. And it isn't just plastic trash and harm to the sea life. It's our human health. We can't use plastics with impunity and imagine that there's no chemical transfer into our bodies, whether to our skin or into our food or into our water. So we have a statewide coalition called Campaign Against the Plastic Plague, CAP. The idea is to cap this terrible waste of single-use disposable plastic. So here we are in one of the cities, San Francisco, that will start up a bag fee, an ordinance to charge users of plastic and paper bags in the city of San Francisco at all major grocery stores. This has been successfully done in places such as Ireland to get rid of 90% of the plastic bag trash virtually overnight.
What happened there when they implemented that? Did people recycle them, or did they begin to use what would make sense would be a reusable, you know, expandable hemp bag, for example, that you just take and use with you all the time? What did they do in Ireland when they implemented this?
Well, I have not been there. But I understand that it was a matter of substitution, using one's own bag, no matter what it was. It might have been an old plastic bag or a cloth bag. And sometimes bags are just taken heedlessly and needlessly, that people get extra bags and walk home or drive home with several bags, whereas they might have been able to do the job with only a few bags.
We just don't think about it. I mean, they're there. They're on the roll. We just use them and use them and use them. And it never would have occurred to me before that there could be some sort of toxic transfer that in some way could affect my body. Talk a little bit about that. You mentioned last night about certain popular drinking bottles. We don't have to necessarily name it, or we can, because that's just who we are.
It's all public record.
and how that impacts us. I mean, and again, I don't want to be alarmist. I want people to know stuff that you're not going to hear otherwise, so that when you continue your ways, you'll have a little bit more integrated knowledge and you'll say, huh, now I'm being a little more at choice on issues I didn't previously fully comprehend.
Right. Well, there is migration of chemicals in plastic and chemical additives to plastic into food and water and our skin. These include phthalates, bisphenol A, other substances that are very dangerous to us. There's a fire retardant called DECA that has been identified as similar to PCBs as to the effects on mammals. So when we are looking at plastics, we would like to think that they're clean, that they are harmless, that it's a wonder product, but most people don't even know it's from petroleum.
Right.
And petroleum is a toxic substance, a number of toxic substances. When crude oil and natural gas are cooked and changed and broken down molecularly and other chemicals added, we have quite a dangerous mix of chemicals that we're in contact with all the time. And because there wasn't an instant effect, like putting your hand on a hot stove and recoiling in pain, people would like to think, oh, it's all right just to have this all this plastic in my life. But people don't even know what this stuff is, and no one does after the product is made and is on the loose in the environment. You don't know what kinds of additives or what combinations of plastics are in a certain plastic product. So to get them out of our lives is a very good thing to do for our health and for other forms of life. The sea life has been terribly impacted. And at the same time, we're able to cut down on petroleum. So if people can take plastic seriously and cut back on that, that may be the start. And that's why I'm in the anti-plastics movement, because it is petroleum. And it's a way to get people to think about this consumption of petroleum products and peak oil.
Right. You know, I was thinking again about how we change, right? How do people change? Firstly, we need to know that we need to have information. We need to know that there's something about our present way that isn't necessarily fully serving us, and that that needs to be something that we perceive as either causing us pain or that an alternative way will be better for us in order for us to shift the way that we're doing things. So, or the choice is taking it away from us, which is a third option that we were talking about last night, that as we reach a point in the world where there oil is scarce and we're not able to produce all these plastics, that the choice to be able to interact with them and to have them in our lives will be just simply removed because we won't be able to create them. But back to the subject of how they impact us negatively, when I have my Crystal Springs water bottle that are ubiquitous everywhere, is that dangerous for me, or is it such a minimal level that I really shouldn't be concerned, or is it okay unless I leave it in the sun? I mean, about something as simple as that, I mean, should people be thinking twice
when they
interact with things like that?
And also, they need to remember that there's a lot of propaganda about plastics. That they're harmless, that they can be recycled, that one can exercise some caution in one way or another, and that it'll all be okay. Obviously, you wouldn't put something plastic right on your stove and melt it. But other than that, the rest of the harm and inadvisable uses of plastic that goes on is invisible to people. They just don't want to think about it. But if you consider that one chemical, which is an estrogen imitator, bisphenol A, in the form of 0.1 part per billion, now, if that small amount of that strong chemical will switch a gene on or off to trigger certain illnesses in the human body or in laboratory animals, then what we're getting into is a sort of a rethinking of science, whereas before we thought that more of a certain poison was bad and that very little was all right. It turns out that there may not be safe levels, and the medical establishment has had to admit that there's no safe level of X-rays, for example.
Right. There's so much that we learn after some time has gone by, yet we always stand in ignorance initially. due to convenience on things, typically, right? If something's working for us and it's convenient, we don't want to know that it may or may not be the best thing or may be hurting us in some way. But we have so many examples in our world where later we learned, hey, that wasn't the greatest thing.
Well, I mean, some of us go on to question technology in general and wonder that if something is natural, maybe it doesn't belong in our lives. And we'd like to, some of us are trying to move towards more natural living. So when people can make changes in their daily lives and choose ways of living that are more sustainable and growing more of their own food in their gardens, for example, then there starts to be some psychological relief, at least, to what we're forced to deal with and what the economy is all about. So the more power that we can exert over our own lives and the more community strength we have to supply local needs and the more cooperation there is and mutual aid, we're going to be less dependent on these distantly produced corporate products where there's no accountability. It's all the profit motive for things to get into our lives, into our bodies, and for species to be driven extinct.
Beautifully said. That's precisely why we've started Healthful Living, to promote that very way of life and thinking and practice, to help us to be more at choice about what we do in the world, who we interact with, what we put in our bodies, to recapture reality, what really is healthful for us, and to get away from the default thinking that has overtaken us in the world and just doing what we're told, doing what's just come along, and having our lives and our health be dictated by those so far away who do not have our best interests at heart. Time is coming very rapidly in the world where we must all as individuals reclaim that personal responsibility over everything that we do, everybody that we interact with, everything that we eat, or the people that we spend our money with. We have to get to recapture those choices so that we're not doing business with people that lie to us. We're not eating things that are that can negatively impact us. Tell us a little bit more about one more thing on this plastic subject. Back to the oceans. Oh, I was so shocked at this film last night about how much plastic there is rolling around in the ocean.
I'm glad you got back to that. Captain Charles Moore took his research catamaran out to the middle of the Pacific and was shocked to find all this plastic trash out there. So further research voyages were made, and it turns out that in a given volume of water, there's 6 times as much plastic particle as zooplankton. Now, that is something that is very alarming, not just because the sea life ingest this, but that this is very long-lasting. As we talked about earlier, it does not biodegrade. It just gets broken down into smaller and smaller bits sometimes. And some forms of plastic out there are the basic pre-production so-called nurdles, these small oval-shaped bits of plastic that are used to make other plastics into various shapes and types. And these nurdles really resemble krill. And so birds and fish are consuming these, and the color is often just the same as well as krill. So with the fish and the birds consuming various kinds of plastic, and albatrosses, for example, feeding bottle caps to their young, creating asphyxiation and starvation, we have a situation where this poisoning from the plastics and the chemicals adhering to the plastics go up the food chain. Now, the plastics have attracted to them things like DDT and PCBs. So when this is concentrated, and it can be a million times more concentrated on the surface of plastic than in the ambient seawater, then this gets into the fatty tissues of and the the stomachs and other parts of smaller organisms, and then larger organisms eat those smaller organisms, and we get this biomagnification of these poisons. And it gets to us eventually. So we have people who have never really been exposed directly to these chemicals with such chemicals in their breast milk, for example.
Right. It's showing up. You know, I mean, we've got fish eating plastic. Then we go out and eat the fish. Our own waste is coming back to us in all these different cycles.
Oh, in many ways, yes. Plastics getting into our systems isn't just a problem for coastal or island people or people who eat fish, because if you look at the average indoor environment that has these flame retardants in them, for example, this very toxic flame retardant known as DECA, this one may be on your windowsill in the form of some dust. It's coming out of sofas. There are hard plastics such as computer casings that have it in there. After a while, we don't want these things to burn after all. So when we have these substances floating around in the air and touching our skins and getting into our food and water, then we start to pile these substances up in our own tissues. And so you have cancer on the increase, but there isn't a direct relationship with any particular chemical usually. Mm-hmm. It's hard to find.
Right.
Except in the case of asbestos, a particular kind of cancer killing thousands of people in this country every year, that is directly traced.
We've got to learn to take care of ourselves. We have to learn to avoid things that we're learning more and more that are toxins that we're putting in our body. We need to avoid them, stay away. For me, plastic has been tough to move away from, but we now have stainless steel water bottles. I feel good every time I have that. We have all these little plastic jars in the house now that we – or glass jars that we put things into now that I suppose is what people did before we had ubiquitous plastic. Move back
right.
to those things. And again, moving back to not being alarmist, just sharing information that you're not going to hear elsewhere. Wake up a bit more to the realities around us. And plastic is a big one. It's everywhere in our world. But we need to be understanding that it does come from petroleum. There is toxic transfer from the plastics to ourselves, especially when we're interacting with it with our food, that we should be aware of and just think a little bit more as we interact with it and do our best to reduce our interaction with it.
And one of those reasons is war for oil.
Yes, exactly. In the last 10 minutes or so, Jan, I'd like to talk a little bit about the peace movement. You were speaking to me just last night a bit about this. You were mentioning how there were so few people last Saturday at the anti-war rally. You've been an activist for many years now. Where are we and where are we, the people, in standing up and fighting for our inherent human rights and peace on the planet and what we feel we inherently desire as a whole bunch of humans trying to live together and make it work?
Well, on the whole, if I had to offer a cynical and pessimistic analysis, it may be just that with plenty of petroleum mm-hmm. and cash, people don't feel that they have to make any changes in their daily lives. And they figure, well, our opportunity to change things came last November 2nd,
right.
And that has passed, and so we can't do anything, and there are people in power and experts out there, so who are we, the common people, to do anything? And after all, things are pretty good. We're the greatest nation on earth, and I've got my job and my stash, my house,
yep.
my cash, so who cares? So maybe those are the principal reasons that people did not show up in great numbers. One probably can assume that there is more moral outrage over the Iraq war than would be indicated by the presence of only a few thousand people at rallies that should have been incredibly well-intended. It may be, though, that we have to look deeply at the anti-war movement and to question whether that really is the approach. When we break things down into reductionist components and talk only about a particular war or a particular problem in the environment or a kind of corruption in government or other crises that are bothering us and are causing misery to us or people around the planet, more so usually, it may be that the kind of movement that would interest people and get them to turn out in greater numbers and to be more active on a daily basis instead of just showing up for a demonstration once in a while would be a movement that takes into account the issues of war and peace and petroleum and the way we relate to one another so that we are banding together in cooperation and improving our lives. So if a anti-war movement is not going to deal with certain issues and wants to follow a certain party line, if you will, and doesn't talk about the problem of driving using oil and creating the basis for a war for oil.
Sure.
If that is a taboo subject, and that's what I heard from International Answer when I went to their headquarters and participated in a couple of meetings, they just didn't want me to speak at a podium about war for oil being a problem that we ourselves are responsible for to a great extent. They figured that a given potential protester may not come to the rally if some kind of a guilt trip were given on the person that driving is contributing to the problem.
Right. We certainly wouldn't want to take personal responsibility, would we?
Well, it is important to have the largest possible coalition, but if you narrow things too much, then you lose relevance to people's everyday lives. So we have to talk about everyday life problems and issues and ways to improve our lives instead of just saying stop this, no more that, and fantasizing that if we can just get rid of the Bushies or if we can just have a different ruler from the Democrats for a change.
Mm-hmm. If somebody else will just change, if they, who are making it so difficult for us, will just change their ways, then everything will be okay for me down here as a sole individual. I won't have to do much. But what we're learning and what we've always really known is that change has to come from the inside out and it has to come from individuals making different choices in their own lives about how they want to be in the world and connecting with like-minded others.
Exactly. And with enough people doing this and with enough change growing and building, then there may be a change in the culture and values can start to shift and people will wonder, well, do we really want to pave over the last arable land and get rid of wildlife habitat in our farms so that we can have more so-called development and short-sighted job growth? So with the kinds of changes that people can make, And in questioning what is being fed to them by the major media and unfortunately their schools and on the job as well, people are going to have to look for changes in their own lives and in their culture. And getting back to the anti-war movement, if they can somehow if anti-war organizers and peace activists can bring more issues together and unify people who are already concerned about so many interrelated issues, it may be that they will have to develop their own virtual territory, a network of people who are working for change and who are supporting each other and making it possible to make changes in energy consumption and supporting each other through bartering.
Right.
Local jobs and growing our food locally. So the latest culture change letter that is about to go out is about territory. It's about activists and hipsters who don't seem to have a plan and wondering about where the anti-war movement was taking us, and it doesn't seem to be succeeding, prompted this latest exploration. And people can get it on culturechange.org in the next day or so.
Thank you for that. I agree. I believe that what's going to happen in the future, and myself playing a role in that as well, is networks of people who do get it, who are waking up, who do realize that we need to make a change, are just going to begin to do it and organize on their own and create new systems, new ways of being, new ways of sharing their resources, new ways of connecting with one another, and get away from expending all of their energy in fighting a system and hoping that they're just going to change. Because it's there's an expression, I don't know if I can say it on the radio, but it has to do with going into the bathroom into the wind, right? Where we're ceaselessly striving for somebody else to change for us when the time is getting critical and we just need to start doing it ourselves. We always want somebody else to go first.
Well, solidarity is, I think you were probably about to say, helping each other and backing each other up in the changes that we have to make and to protect nature, to fight for a cleaner environment and for human rights. This brings us to something coming up this April 11th, approximately, if the trial is held on that day, in the federal court of Judge Ilsen, there will be the trial of the Humboldt County law enforcement agencies that tortured activists who were nonviolently locked down to try to protect the ancient redwoods. And I think we were going to close with a song, track one on the Deep Havers album.
We are going to
Daughter
close.
Spring. And the singer with me there is my daughter, who is one of the plaintiffs in this case.
Jan, thank you for being here. And you'll be with us again, I think, in about 4 or 5 weeks. You're listening to Reality Sandwich Radio on KPOO 89.5 FM, where every Thursday at noon, we serve up a palatable taste of the truth on topics of the mind, the body, and the planet. My name is Martin Matthews. I'm a certified medical hypnotherapist and healthful living advocate. You can reach me at healthfullivingsf.com, and you can email me there with any questions you have about the show, any topics you'd like to hear about, any comments about today's subjects or anything else that you have in your mind. Thank you for tuning in. Next week, Julie will be back with Ayurvedic practitioner Renita Malhotra. Thank you for tuning in.
Have a global warming day. Have a global warming day. Have a global warming day. Masu masu tsui ne. Masu masu tsui ne. Masu masu tsui ne. Watch the ice caps melt away. Have a global warming day. Masu masu tsui ne.